And the first question, as you know already, is the field of rhetoric and composition is devoted to the study of the practice of writing and its consequences. And we wondered if you thought of yourself as a writer and what role writing played in the development of your thought.
Well, I suppose I can say I am a writer in some sense. The point is that the category of writing is not a unified category. It can refer to many different type of writings. I see myself these days as a theoretical writing. The way in which I try to operate is basically through the production of theory. But it has not been always the case. For instance, when I was still in Argentina for several years, I was the editor of a weekly left-wing left-wing weekly, and so there I was engaged into some form of journalism all the time.
Okay. And let us ask question three first. In Richard Rorty's Liberal Utopia, persuasion replaces force as a principal social arrangement. And in your critique of Rorty, you demonstrate that not only is it impossible to oppose persuasion and force, but that persuasion is one form of force. And you add that persuasion cannot simply be reduced to force. Would you elaborate on the relationship of persuasion to force?
Yes. In the first place, the category of persuasion, as used by Rorty, has played the function of, let's say, reducing the epistemological the epistemological ambitions of a dialogical exchange. For instance, as the case of is the case with Habermas, because Habermas sustained that finally a dialogical situation would be able, at least as an ideal point of arrival, to conclude in a situation in which one and only one position is maintained by people intervening in the dialogue. On the other hand, Rorty does not believe that. He believes in the purely conversational nature of the agreement that people reach, and that is why persuasion is a category as important for him as it is. Now, what I was trying to do in the piece to which you refer is to try to deepen into this logic of persuasion and to find out whether in persuasion, which is the opposite for force, for Dick Rorty, there is not an element of force, so that one can deconstruct the opposition, persuasion and force. So what I think I have shown in that piece is that persuasion, precisely because it never presents an argument which should be accepted algorithmically, involves, if you want, an element of rhetoric in itself. For instance, if you think in the whole arguments, the quasi-logical arguments of Shane Perelman and all his analysis about how persuasion operate, you see that this element of force necessarily has to be included. You persuade by something less than a rational type of demonstration. Now, what is this something less? There you can have many possible answers, and all of them would be valid depending on the situation. For instance, you can provoke the sympathy of the listener. You can, on the other hand, present the argument so forcefully that you intimidate the listener, and you know the whole range of these possibilities. Now, there is one which for me is particularly important, because that leads to central questions in theory of hegemony. And it is that when you are confronted with a situation in which there is no clear answer, but in which, however, the answer is needed, the fact that there is one answer becomes more important than the concrete character of the answer which is involved there. Now, that is, if you want, an element of force, force not in the sense of a physical force, but is force in the sense that it is less than purely rational demonstration. A purely rational demonstration would absolutely collapse the difference between the ontic character of the response and the ontological character of being a response. But my argument is that in any dialogical situation, these two elements never collapse, and that is what leads to the construction of the pure alternative force persuasion. Like, for instance, in other sense, in the Anglo-American discussion, has been very usual when we come to the notion of the decision, which is something I understand you want to discuss later. The distinction is made between the cause of a decision and the motive of a decision. The cause being what provoked the decision. For instance, if a fly comes to my forefront and I say, well, I take this decision, this would be the cause, but not the motive. Now, I think there is nothing more complicated than distinguishing cause and motive, precisely because a motive is never totally algorithmically grounded. Being things as that, well, we have to play around the construction of this stark opposition in which traditional rationalistic discourses were grounded.
That certainly makes a lot of sense. All right, then following up on that, throughout your work, you insist that hegemony must be the key concept of political analysis. And you say that hegemony is not the imposition of a pre-given set of ideas and practices, but something that emerges from the political interaction of groups. That is, hegemony is not a simple matter of forceful domination by an elite, but rather is a process of ongoing struggle that constitutes the social. Now, in Emancipation, you at times seem to suggest an identification between hegemony and persuasion, and at other times you assert that the internal logic of the hegemonic operation underlies the process of persuasion, which seems to suggest maybe a distance or a difference between the two. Can you tell us exactly how you perceive the relationship of persuasion and hegemony? You've already started that, of course, in your other answer.
Yes, well, let's ignore. I think we can start by from the point in which we ended in the previous answer. The question of hegemony, in fact, is linked to that precise situation in which something is missing and a particular content assumes the relationship between this missing something. For instance, using an example that I have, referring to an example that I have used in one of my pieces, at the beginning of the, in the immediate post-war period in Italy, people used to say that the fascists had succeeded in carrying out the revolution in which the communists had failed. Now, apparently this is nonsense, because the fascist revolution, the communist revolution, from the point of view of their content, would have been completely different. So what created the acceptability of such an assertion? Simply the fact that revolution for people meant the realization that the Italian state had to be founded again, that the type of political organization which has emerged from the Risorgimento was in tatters, and that as a result of this, some radical refoundation of the Italian state was needed. Now, in the political semantics of the time, this was meant, is what it was meant by revolution. Now, it has a a purely negative content, because revolution means the fullness of society, which is lacking. And when people are in a situation of radical disorder, people need some kind of order, and the nature of the particular order is secondary. Now, this particular relationship in which a certain particular content assumes the function of a universal fullness, which is totally incommensurable with it, is exactly what I call a hegemonic relationship. Now, as you see, the dimension of force is present there, and the dimension of persuasion has to be present there as well, in the sense that we have mentioned before. If we had a dialogical situation in which we reach, at least as a regulative idea, a point in which between the ontic and the ontological dimension would be no difference, there would be a complete overlapping, in that case there would be nothing to hegemonize, because this absent fullness of the community could be given by one and only one political content. But as there is no overlapping there between particularity and universal function, in that case the relation is going to be hegemonic, because there is going to be always a precarious taking up of this universal function by the particularity of social forces. To give you another example, in the classical Marxist conception, the moment of universality was the moment of a simplification of the social structure under capitalism. For instance, universality was a category coming from the Hegelian philosophy of right. For him, the universal class was bureaucracy. Marx says bureaucracy, that is to say the state, is not the moment of the universal of the community, but is an instrument of the ruling class, so it's also a moment of particularity. So how to reach the moment of universality if you have only the dispersion of concrete interest in civil society? And the answer was, this is only possible if there is something going on at the level of civil society by which the moment of universality will emerge there. And this was the emergence of the proletariat, which through the increasing simplification of the social structure under capitalism could represent the point of view of the totality of the community, and from this point of view, universality. Now, when society did not advance in that direction, the result is that we have the proliferation of differences in civil society and what happened with the moment of universality. This was exactly the problem of Gramsci. And the answer to that was was hegemony. Now, hegemony, he developed theoretically up to a certain point. Now, I think these two dimensions, universality and particularity, on which I think we will discuss later, come together through this particular mechanism.
That's a very good answer. See, you see that some of these questions are geared to helping some of those people in the field that may not have read some of your work.
And this is, yes,
these kinds of answers.
And to entice them.
Yeah, okay, yeah, good.
So this is very good. This is one of the questions that you said you might need some clarification from. Literacy theorists associated with what is often called liberatory learning, and let me just take a step back from that for a second and say, there are quite a few people that are interested in a kind of a connection between the acquisition of literacy and the empowerment of oppressed peoples to sort of struggle against or resist the oppression that they might be under. And a major person who theorized some of the liberatory learning was the Brazilian
Paulo Freire.
Freire. Yeah, yeah. You know his work. And so that's a tradition of that's often called liberatory learning, or sometimes radical pedagogy.
It's mostly Marxist inspired. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, or sort of old Marxist inspired, I guess. Yeah, and that's the term liberatory learning. And some of these people contend that literacy is a key element in the emancipation of oppressed groups. Also, on another playing field, many feminists agree. For example, Donna Haraway commented in one of our interviews that, quote, you can't talk about the history of contemporary liberation struggles without talking about liberatory
that should be
literacy projects. I'm sorry, that should be literacy projects.
Ah, I see.
And so the question is, what do you believe is the role of literacy projects in struggles against oppression?
One question before answering. By what is understood by literacy? Is what to have access to reading and writing?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a good question.
That's
yeah.
Under debate. It can be functional literacy, just being able to read and write.
Yes.
But it can also be more, what we might call more advanced forms of literacy, which would include being able to critique power structures, being able to have some critical vocabulary that you could critique.
Yes, in fact, that's exactly right. What one of Paulo Freire's main contributions to that is, and forgive me, Ed, for the pronunciation, but concienciação, the Portuguese...
Concienciação.
Concienciação.
Right.
Right. And so that's that kind of critical consciousness that that one develops that makes one aware, first, of one's oppression and of the kinds of power structures that are at play and hegemonic forces at play. You see, he ties literacy with that kind of awareness. And so it's not, as Lynn was saying, it's not just simply the, for these people, the simple acquisition of, alphabetic writing,
yes,
and reading, but the tying of that with this kind of awareness, this kind of critical awareness.
Just going to expand and say that, the history of feminism in the United States,
mm-hmm,
is, I think, a lot about education, teaching women to understand that the personal is political, to have a more critical relationship to structures of so-called patriarchal oppression. So
thank
it
you.
Links up with what we're calling here liberatory learning.
Okay, well, let me say the following. As far as I understand the concept, the question of the role of literacy project conceived in this broad sense would be close to what, for instance, Foucault called a proliferation of discourses. In a situation of in which emancipatory struggles start, there is always a whole transformation at the discursive level. You know how to handle a set of situations to which you didn't have access before. So discourses against oppression, if we understood by that the notion of literacy in its widest sense, are absolutely essential for any struggle against oppression. And there I would like to add something. In general, situations of oppression are not situations in which the oppressed recognizes himself or herself immediately as such. Are situations in which, in some sense, the identity of the oppressed has a breaking up, and in which precisely these tools of liberation struggle, which are discourses, are not present. At the moment in which they start being present, is we are in a situation in which the oppression begins to be radically a question and in which different outcomes are possible. For instance, in many areas of the third world, you find not interest, class interest in the classical sense, because class interests were conceived as constituted around positions in the production process. What you find in many places in the third world is that people don't have a precise insertion in the production process because there is a wide situation of social marginality. And when you have a situation of social marginality, the idea of an interest given by your objective insertion in the relation of production simply does not work. I remember, for instance, that in the 1930s, in the middle of the economic world crisis, Trotsky wrote that if the levels of unemployment continue at if unemployment continue at the present level, we won't be able any longer to conceive the unemployed in terms of the Marxian category of industrial reserve army. And if this is so, the whole Marxian theory of the classes has to be thought, because the category of classes does not embrace everything that has to be embraced in order to conceptualize oppression. Now, in this situation, many times, and this is related with something you, I think you were going to ask me later on, but has come now, you find that populist discourses emerge many times at the level of national politics, which start giving to people a sense of identity, and that they have to reconstruct at the political level through these discourses, which could be new forms of literacy in the broad sense that we are defining, an identity which does not emerge spontaneously at the level of civil society. This is, for instance, why I think there is a shift in my conception about this matter. When we wrote Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, we were arguing still that the moment of dislocation of social relations, the moment which constitutes the limit of the objectivity of social relation, is given by antagonism. Now, later on I came to think that this was not enough, because to construct a social dislocation of an antagonism is already a recursive response. You construct the other, who dislocate your identity, as an enemy. But there are alternative forms. For instance, people can say this is the expression of the wrath of God. Mm-hmm. This is the expression of our sins, and we have to prepare for the Day of Atonement. So there is already a discursive organization in constructing somebody as an enemy, which involves a whole technology of power in the mobilization of the oppressed. So that is why in New Reflections, I have insisted in the primary character of dislocation rather than antagonism.
That makes sense. In New Reflections, you write, there is democracy as long as there is the possibility of unlimited questioning. And in The Politics and Limits of Modernity, you write, the sense of an intellectual intervention emerges only when it is possible to reconstitute the system of questions that it seeks to answer. Now, your focus on questioning should be of particular interest to liberatory teachers, the kind of people we're talking about, whose pedagogical problem, arguably, is to teach students to recognize and ask questions that produce an intellectual intervention in the given historical discursive formation. The question, of course, is how to do this, how to convey to students the sense of the vital importance of questions and questioning.
Well, about the last question, I think I'm not the person to answer it. It's somebody who is engaged in teaching students in this particular sense.
Or anybody, but definitely
Paulo Freire would have absolute answers to this, good answer to this question, but I'm not really the person to answer it. However, what I would like to elaborate a moment is on the strong distinction question and answer. Because the point is there any question which is not already, in some sense, an answer to what it is posing? I think questions operate not as purely neutral questions, which leave the field of the answer entirely open, but questions always operate in the sense of narrowing the field of the answer which is possible to put in a certain situation. So questioning is already the first step in the organization of a discursive field. Now, if we were speaking about literacy in the wide sense, as in the previous question, in that case, to create a culture of questions is absolutely important. It's perhaps what distinguishes a dogmatic education or a dogmatic approach to any kind of social practice from a position which is not dogmatic, which is open. It cannot be totally open, because in that case there would be no questions either. But it cannot be entirely closed either. So I would see the whole complex of the relationship question-answer as a continuum in which there are different levels of closeness. For instance, for democratic theory, this is important, because questions close a certain field constitute a community which poses itself a set of problems, but at the same time maintains relatively open the fields of the answer. Now, a community which is in which there is no community of question is not a community at all.
This is going to be very helpful.
Okay.
Well, one of the reasons why I think we wanted to talk to you is because your work actually strikes me as teaching us to ask new kinds of questions, questions that, you know, other theorists are, you know, putting us into the area of, but not with maybe the same emphasis or focus or whatever. And, you know, the very work that you do, I think, teaches us to ask new kinds of questions.
Okay, well, glad.
You have defined hegemony as a logic of articulation and articulation as a political construction from dissimilar elements. And you've also said that articulation cannot just be conceived as the linkage of dissimilar and fully constituted elements. For instance, your own work takes the best fragments of Marxist theory and links them with useful elements from postmodern theory to intervene productively in the present theoretical and political situation. As a discursive practice, articulation is of potential use to those of us who study liberatory possibilities of literacy and writing. What do you see as the role of the concept of articulation, possibly for a theory of writing?
Okay. Firstly, about articulation. Articulation is a category which started being important for this type of analysis only with Althusserianism. Before that, we only have heard of articulated lorries, no? And but it became a theoretically relevant question precisely because Althusser was trying to think a combination of elements which, according to classical Marxist theory, were uncombinable because they belong to different stages of social evolution. For instance, the notion of articulation or mode of production became very much in use in the 1960s in order to define situations in the third world where you have this incorporation into a world economy of economic of mode of production which were not capitalist and which, however, were integrated within the structure of a world capitalism. Now, the way I have developed the notion of articulation in relation to hegemony is the following. As you very well point out here, we cannot conceive of articulation as the linkage of dissimilar and fully constituted elements, precisely because if the elements were fully constituted, in that case, the articulation would not play any kind of grounding role. If you want to conceive of articulation, you can go, for instance, to the Saussurean model. And in the Saussurean model, as far as language is a system of difference, this means, on the one hand, that the social totality, in some sense, is presupposed by this, this signifying totality, let's say, not extrapolate too much. Signifying totality is presupposed by any single act of signification, but at the same time is exposed to new elements, because new elements are going to be to produce a new articulation of everything which was within the structure. So, articulation in this sense became the basic category of social analysis as far as all social practices are signifying practices. Now, let's see the questions themselves more precisely. Well, when we say that we take the best fragments of Marxist theory, what we are saying is that by these fragments entering into articulatory practices with other elements, they are transforming their nature. There are a set of categories that still can be there, but which, however, play a completely different role than they play in classical Marxism. Now, one question here off the record. When you ask me about the concept of articulation in a theory of writing, what are you aiming at? I want to see the sense of the question a bit more clearly.
Well, I was curious about the potential for using either explicitly or implicitly the idea of articulation, the concept of articulation, in teaching students to think through writing, okay? To think mm-hmm. in the process of writing. Writing is a process of thinking.
Yes.
That there's a sort of an unfolding of thought in the process of writing. Here I'm talking about any level of student, graduate students and undergraduate students, because I teach both. And I'm I worry a lot about their writing.
And the thinking and writing are so interconnected. And we talk, you're in many ways talking away from thinking.
And so I was interested in the possibilities of the concept of articulation for how it is we go about putting together elements of different theories, different discourses, to then produce some kind of intellectual intervention. This is particularly relevant, I think, for graduate education, trying to teach graduate students to be, you know, really good thinkers, so that they can produce first-rate works. So, you know, that it's not just a simple recombination, you know, in some sort of, you know, a simple kind of recombination of other people's ideas that really goes nowhere and does nothing, but the kind of combination that actually produces this kind of intellectual intervention, which is what I think is the goal of graduate education, training PhDs, you know, and the kind of writing we want them to do, the kind of writing we want them to do in their PhD dissertation, actually does this kind of combination that
Well,
the idea of articulation gets us at to.
Yeah. I wonder to what extent the most relevant category for that purpose would not be the category of inscription. That is to say that any writing is a process of inscription. And by inscription here I mean a process in which, through putting two things together, the nature of these two things is in some way modified. Mm-hmm. For instance, you were speaking about PhD thesis. I have a long experience as a PhD supervisor. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the most difficult problems that I have found is to have the students not establishing a radical separation between case study and theoretical framework. Because otherwise you could finish in a situation in which the theoretical chapter could be identical in all the theses, and the case study is the only thing which changed from one to the other, which means that the two things would not have been articulated at all. It's like coming back to the Saussurean example that I was giving before. By definition, if language is a system of difference, and by extension any signifying structure is like that, the incorporation of new element has to modify all the elements of the whole. And in theoretical discourses, this means that there is no case study for minimal, which should not modify the theory as well. Now, if articulation is defined in this particular sense, the conclusion is that through each case study, in fact, the ideology of the case study has to be broken, the theory itself has to be, in some sense, modified not in the sense of putting it aside, but simply showing theoretical aspects through a new light. And at the same time, the case study, that is comparatively more easy, can be inscribed within a theory. But the moment of inscription operates in the two ways. And my experience is that it's one of the most difficult things for graduate students to learn how to do. But it makes the whole difference between a purely scholarly exercise scholarly in the bad sense of the term, simply showing that you have understood the theory enough as to be able to competently apply it to some case, and to enter in a process in which the theory illuminates the case and the case illuminates the theory. I think the whole distinction between empirical and theoretical research has to be put from this point of view into question. And from this point of view, the category of articulation, I think, can help to think about the matter.
That helps a lot. One of the things that occurred to me as you were talking is that what I don't want to happen is for there to be a kind of misunderstanding and a collapsing of the distinction between articulation and this notion of pastiche, postmodern pastiche, where you just you see it in architecture, but you also see it in theoretical works where things are just sort of stuck together without this kind of mutual modification that you're talking about. Are you familiar with that term, pastiche?
Yes, yeah. Of course.
Frederick Jameson sort of critiques postmodernism for that kind of cannibalism of the past and just recombining elements.
Oh yes, and I, from that point of view, I agree very much with his analysis, which is when the pastiche is used consciously, it has produced effects of meaning which are not bad, but it's not above modern. Kind of writing. I'm thinking, for instance, in chaotic enumeration in surrealist poetry. Mm-hmm. That is, in some sense, a certain pastiche, but it's always a pastiche in which you are not simply superposing things, but mm-hmm. you are creating rhetorical effects, mm-hmm. metonymic or metaphoric, whatever it is, in order to do that. Yes, I agree.
Okay. Next question. Your work is a critique, on the one hand, of the postmodern position that privileges pure contextualism, what you call particularism, and that historicizes the concept of the universal, and on the other hand, of the Enlightenment position that privileges universalism and seeks to transcend all particularism. You attempt to forge a third way, a dialectic that demonstrates the relational interdependence of the universal and the particular. What are the theoretical and political exigencies that compel you to make this move?
Yes. Well, in the first place, I think that pure particularism is an operation which is impossible. Because if you are saying pure particularity, each pure particularity has to define itself by a difference with other particularity, and the system of all this particularity necessarily reconstruct a certain universality, and the worst form of universality, because the universality conceived as a ground. This is the first question, the first theoretical difficulty. Political difficulty is that I don't think pure particularism can do the job. Because what would be the particularism of a certain community? If this community is a particular one, this means that it does not overlap exactly with the community conceived as a whole. In that case, is going to be submitted to a set of pressure from outside itself, let's suppose. If you have national minorities or racial minorities or ethnic minorities, let's say, let's not use the concept of race in a very wide way, ethnic minorities and so on, or cultural minority, in that case, one of the requests in order to assert their particularism would be the right of these communities to assert their identity. Now, if you assert the right of all community to its own identity, what you are asserting is a universal principle. That is why I think context, there is a strong tendency to contextualization in contemporary politics and in contemporary theory. But precisely because this movement towards contextualization, there is a different movement, which is a movement of decontextualization. For instance, a discourse of rights is going to be a decontextualizing discourse, because as far as it is not a purely xenophobic discourse, will have to assert itself in terms of some universality. Now, what is wrong with the idea of universality in the classical sense? That it gave to universality a content which can be specified in absolutely positive terms. Man is a rational animal, or is this or that, and so on. And in this sense, subordinated to a content which in the last analysis is always particular and was associated with a tradition of certain culture, giving it a universal a function. For instance, the problem of democracy, as it was conceived from the 18th century, was based in a discourse of equalization. The universalism of the French Revolution led into that direction. Marxism, because he thought, as we said before, that there was an increasing homogenization of social structure, tend to a discourse of universality which was incompatible with difference, which in fact eliminated differences. Today, the problem of democracy is the opposite. Once you have a society in which you have a multiplicity of cultures, demands, interests, and so on, how to combine them in some way which is compatible with the defense of their particularity. This is the problem of democracy today, so that in some sense we are in the antipodes of the classical problem of the democracies. This to say something about the theoretical and political exigencies rough way, no? Now, what I have tried to do in the essay, especially in the essays collected in Emancipation, is to rescue a notion of universality which is not restricted to an a priori given content, and that is given by the notion of hegemony. And they are the notion of empty signifier, which is developed in especially in the essay "Why Do Empty Signifiers Matter to Politics," which is the essay I most like in that volume, try to develop precisely this argument. And if we go back to what we were saying about hegemony before, you see immediately the connection. If the systematicity of the system, the totality, what would constitute the moment of universalization, is something which is both impossible and necessary, it will need to have access to the system of representation. But the system of the forms of representation are going to be constitutively inadequate because they can only be certain particularities. Now, hegemony is the relationship by which, at some point, a certain particularity assumes this function of universal representation. You have there a moment of universality, which, however, cannot be given any kind of positive content, as, for instance, the Habermasian would try to do. But my argument is that this leads to some kind of more democratic, radical democratic politics, because if the moment of universality is had a content given a priori once and for all, no dialogical process would be possible. Things would have been decided from the very beginning. If, on the other hand, this element of universality is going to be necessary, but it does not have a content of its own, and it's only given in a transient way by the particular social force, in that case, hegemonic rearticulation are always possible, and this incompletion of society is what maintains the possibility of a democratic exchange constantly open.
The body of your work suggests the possibility of deepening the project of radical democracy through its articulation with post-structuralism, sort of what you were talking about a minute ago, specifically deconstruction. How might deconstruction become central for a theory of politics? I think we get a sense of this in the particular universal.
Yes.
Already, so.
Well, I think that deconstruction is basically a theory about the decision taken in an undecidable terrain. For instance, in Speech and Phenomena, Derrida shows in what way the articulation between knowledge and meaning in Husserl does not lead necessarily to subordination of meaning to knowledge. He, in fact, emancipates the two dimensions and shows that they can go in a completely different directions. Now, once you have this radical undecidability in the relationship between these two dimensions, he says, Husserl takes an ethico-theoretical decision, which is subordinate one to the other in a new sense. But the contingency of this decision always remained there. For instance, he says, Joyce took exactly the opposite direction than Husserl. Now, if you have undecidability in this radical sense, and on the other hand, you have the need for a decision, for instance, Derrida in his later work insists that there is also an urgency in the decision. I would say the decision is something which one has to take too soon. In that sense, the decision is going to produce some kind of articulation between two elements which is not required at the level of the structure. Now, this is very close to hegemonic articulation in the sense that I was referring before. For instance, the book on Marx, Spectres of Marx, Derrida speaks about the relation of spectrality. Now, a relation of spectrality is very close to a hegemonic relation because let's suppose what is what would be a relation of incarnation. In the Christian sense, an incarnation would be the relationship between an eschatological event and an empirical event which are totally unrelated with each other and simply are put together by the divine intervention. So this divine intervention, because it's completely we cannot find its rationality, we cannot find why the body of Mary was destined to be the body of the Mother of God, because of that, the irrationality of the divine intervention from the point of view of human reason is what kept these two levels separated. But if you are going to have an incarnation without divine intervention, in that case, you will have that the universal eschatological moment, which could not be any longer eschatological, will deform the materiality of the body doing the incarnating job. And at the same time, the incarnated body will contaminate the very universality. And there you are again in this situation of combination between particularity and universality in which the hegemonic relation consists of.
Oh, very good. Thank you. You've said that your preference is for a liberal democratic socialist society, and you often differentiate your vision of a radical democracy from both classical liberal democracy and from the neoconservative effort to redeploy liberal political theory for its own ends. What are the crucial differences between your radicalized notion of democracy and these others?
Okay, the classical liberal notion of democracy was based, was limited to a particular sphere, which was the sphere of citizenship. The public space of citizenship. People said in the private sphere, people can be as different from each other as they want, but they are equal as far as we are concerned with this sphere. As there is in classical liberalism an assertion of of both equality at one level and inequality at other level, the degree of democratization to which this theory can reach is a limited one. That is why we insisted in the notion of democratic revolution, which is based, for instance, in some of the things that, Claude Lefort developed them later, but Tocqueville formulated originally. The argument of Tocqueville said that once people accept the principle of equality in some sphere, they will not accept being equal in one sphere and unequal in a different sphere. They will try to be equal in all spheres. And the arch of the democratic revolution, the way we see it, is the expansion of this logic of equality from the public sphere of citizenship to different spheres. For instance, with socialist discourses in the 19th century to the economic sphere, to the equality between sexual orientation, race, ethnic group, and so on, in this century, to wider and wider section. Now, once you are asserting the principle of equality in this dimension, you are blowing the distinction of operation of equality between a public sphere and a private sphere. That is to say, for instance, you were mentioning before, when women say the personal is political, what they are saying is that the logic of equality expands to a sphere for which originally had not been a thought. Well, classical liberal thought is very much based in this differentiation between the public and the private space, and in that sense cannot advance very much in the direction of radical democracy. And the neoconservative offensive is even much more clear from this point of view. In the private sphere, only individuals can exist. While in that case, logic of equality play practically no role at all. So this would be basically the difference between the two things.
Okay. Thank you. May I interrupt for a second?
Si, yeah, sure.
May I ask, can you put the microphone on your collar? Because it's getting very...
Okay. You will hear my happen, not my voice.
Right. I've been afraid of that.
Yeah.
I was watching the meter.
Yeah. You want more?
Yes, thank you. These answers are very, very helpful, and I think people, it will lead, thank you, a lot of people in the discipline to want to read your work, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Almost halfway done. And question number 10. In an attempt to devise an anti-foundational epistemology, many postmodern thinkers have focused on knowledge as radically contingent, local, and contextualized. Now, many rhetorical theorists, in fact, are fully committed to a neo-pragmatic notion that all knowledge is radically contextual and thus rhetorical. You caution, however, that this approach does not fully consider the limitations of context itself. How might we continue to understand the centrality of context, which it really is very important to many people, while remaining aware of its limitations?
Okay. Let me say in the first place that... I would agree that knowledge is radically contingent, local, and contextualized. So I would accept that view. The difficulties for me start... Yes, you wanted to ask?
No, I just heard.
The difficulty, however, start when one tries to define what is a context. Because... there, for instance, Derrida has written very useful things in the sense of saying that defining the limits of the context is one of the most difficult things you can do. The point is that if in spite of the contextualized nature of every context, there are no logics of relative universalization operating in it. For instance, we were mentioning before in the discussion the question about the discourses of right. For instance, if you have discourses about human rights, in a very ultimate sense, these are contextual rights because they depend on people believing a set of things about human being, which since the 18th century have been expanding more and more. So you have a very, very radical context. BET is obviously not the localized context in which people are thinking when they are making this radical postmodern type of assertion. If context themselves have within themselves this tendency to decontextualization through universalization, in an ultimate ontological sense, context is always dominant, but the dimension of the context are changing all the time. I think that what we have is simply a relative universalization of values. The point is that in current debates, as the whole debate has been against, the whole discussion have gone in the direction of putting into question the essentialist notion of universality, the debate has gone in the opposite direction of asserting pure contextualized particularity. But for the reason we have said, this is not without any difficulties either. So I think we have to operate in the two levels as well, to show, to accept radical contextualism, but to show how, in any context, there is something going beyond the context itself. There, for instance, what we have called in our work the logic of equivalence are very important in order to universalize some values. For instance, you can say women had to fight for their rights as women, Chicanos had to fight for their rights as Chicanos, and so on. But can they fight for their rights without entering into some equivalential logic which put that struggle together with the struggle of other people and in this sense produce a certain relative universalization of values? I don't think this is possible. They have to operate at the same level in this at the level of this contextualized assertion on the one hand, and at the level of this weakened form of universalization of values on the other. What we deny to classical universalism is not this relative and weakened universalization through equivalence. What we deny is that there is something which is universal per se and which does not depend on this contextual interaction in order to create their own relative universalities.
It makes sense to me. Since the early 1980s, the concept of the social has become increasingly central to composition scholarship, as theorists have interrogated the connections between rhetoric and epistemology, close to what we were talking about before. The social is also an important element in your own thinking. For example, you distinguish your view of the social from what might be called a common sense definition of society, an ensemble of physically existing agents who live within a given territory. Such an unnuanced perspective is not uncommon, unfortunately, in composition theory. How might we, in composition, more productively think the social, especially in relation to the political?
Well, I will answer the point concerning the relationship between the social and the political, and you will draw your own conclusions about composition, no? Okay. In fact, the notion of the social in my work has been presented in terms of two contrapositions. One is the relationship between the social and the political, the other the distinction between the social and society. Now, when let's start with this last distinction. By society, I understand simply the possibility of closure of meaning, of all social meaning, around a matrix which can explain all its partial process. That would be, for instance, the vision of a classical structuralism. On the other hand, if one takes a more post-structuralist position, the impossibility of closing any context, and among them the societal context as a unified whole, in that case what you have are marginal processes which constantly disrupt meaning and do not present and do not lead to the closure of society around a single matrix. Now, when we have the social defined in this sense as something which creates meaning but which makes closure impossible, I tended to speak of the social instead of society. That was an early distinction. For instance, in the article on the impossibility of society, that is precisely the argument which is being presented. The second distinction, I think, is more relevant, which is the distinction between the social and the political. And that is connected with the distinction between sedimentation and reactivation, which was a distinction coming from Husserl, as you know. Husserl said that the original acts of production of meaning by a transcendental subject are acts which in the social practice become repetitious and forget the moment of their original institutions. Now, for him, reactivation was to go back to this original intuition through which a sedimented meaning was constituted. Now, the difference is that for Husserl, this moment of reactivation consists in going back to an original intuition which constituted the object and which had a positive content and character. The way I am presenting the argument is that the moment of, we live in a world of a sedimented social practice. Now, the moment of reactivation consists not in going to an original founding moment, as in Husserl, but at an original contingent decision through which the social was instituted. Now, this moment of institution of the social through contingent decision is what I call the political. Now, in some sense, we are living in a world in which the social is explaining 80% of our social practices, while there are areas of undecidability in which acts of institution of a political nature required. For instance, if you live in a period of relative social stability, you are going to have that the social expand at the expenses of the political. If you are living in an organic crisis period, in the Gramscian sense, obviously many more areas of social life are susceptible of political construction. Now, the way I see the history of social theory is that up to the end of the 17th century, the threatened communities, the threatened European communities, which had emerged from the war of religion, put themselves very much the problem of the political nature of the social link. For instance, Hobbes would be a typical example. And so political philosophy occupied a central role. From the 18th century onward, what happened is, on the contrary, an increasing confidence of society in its ability to self-regulation. From the invisible hand of Adam Smith to sociology in the 19th century, there is a progressive abandonment of the perspective of political analysis, of political philosophy, an increasing sociologization of the categories of analysis of society. Now, I think today we are, in some sense, returning to a consideration of the political nature of the social, precisely because people have less confidence in the mechanism of self-reproduction. For instance, in conditions of globalization, you need to produce all the time political forms of rearticulation in order to make the society work to some extent. So probably today we are in a process in which the political is returning, to use an expression by Chantal, occupy a more central role in the understanding of social mechanisms.
Okay. In Community and its Paradoxes, you state, I'm very much in favor of reintroducing the dimension of violence within reform. A world in which reform takes place without violence is not a world in which I would like to live. And in fact, you claim that the existence of violence and antagonisms is the very condition of a free society. In what ways is violence constitutive of the social? And what limitations, if any, would you place on the uses of violence?
Okay. This is related to an argument that I have presented in New Reflections, in my letter to Aleta Norval, in which the argument that I pose is essentially that the possibility, in fact it's related with a question that comes later on in your questionnaire, but I have to tackle it now at this. The possibility of a free society depends on the existence of relation of power. The argument is approximately the following. What is taking a decision? Taking a decision can obey two mechanisms, either of two mechanisms. For instance, if I have a decision, I'm confronted with a set of alternatives, but the solution to which is the best alternative is an algorithmic solution, that is to say that there is one and only one possible solution to this set of alternatives. In that case, I am not taking the solution. The structure has taken the decision, The structure has taken the decision for me. So, in what case I have an option, really? Simply in case that the field of the decision is indeterminate. That is to say that the decision can be mine only as far as the structure does not determine which is the good one. But this means that taking a decision is to some extent, in the last instance, arbitrary. Now, when we pass from individual decisions to the realm of collective decisions, groups of people will prefer one decision, other group of people will prefer a different one. Now, the result of this is that as there is no ultimate algorithm which can arbitrate between them, the mechanism by which one decision is imposed at the expenses of the other is going to involve power in some sense, even in the limited sense of winning an election. People will be imposed things that they do not want to. Now, in this sense, taking decisions and making and establishing relations of power go necessarily together. Now, I would argue that this is not bad. This is violence, power, but it's not bad. Why? Because the other alternative would be that all decisions are algorithmic, but in that case, we would have no freedom at all The only thing we would have is the Spinozian freedom of being conscious of necessity. And in that society, as I said here, I would not like to live because it's a society from which freedom would have been totally eliminated. And this is the paradox of freedom, that in order to have freedom, you have to institute the other of freedom, which is power. You can destroy some forms of power, but the destruction of these forms of power will involve establishing new relations of power of different kind. And what you refer in here, not in here, but in your later question, in what sense an unrestricted freedom would not be possible? My answer is, it wouldn't be possible because a freedom, which is an unrestricted freedom, would be the same thing as the lack of freedom at all, as a complete lack of freedom. You only can free some things by unfreeing some others. And in this sense, power and hegemony is constitutive of social relation. At some point, for instance, you want to free women from oppression, but freeing women from oppression will mean to establish relation of power over people who oppose this process of freedom. What the whole argument is again is the idea of a reconciled society from which all antagonism and power relation would have been eliminated.
Well, certainly you would put some limitations, though. Would you not put limitations on the violence that gets constituted?
I think I would put limitation, but I cannot determine this limitation except by conceiving a certain context. For instance, in some context, I would be perfectly happy to incur an act of terrorism to destroy a very oppressive regime. In other contexts, no. The terrorism that the resistance in France used during the Second World War, destroying railway stations and all this kind of thing, is a terrorism in that context that I'm perfectly prepared to subscribe. So the problem of the limitation of violence, I don't think, can be solved on the basis of a blueprint determining in a rationalistic way what kind of violence is good and what is bad. That depends.
We were sure you would say that.
Yeah.
One could argue that the debate about multiculturalism in the United States is stalled precisely by a politics of recognition and an imperative to celebrate difference. And you assert in Subject to Politics that a politics of pure difference is the route to self-apartheid. What do you see as the dangers of the construction of political identities exclusively through a logic of difference?
Well, the danger, which is not only a danger in pure particularism, in multiculturalism, in fact, I want to stress this point, is a danger which is implicit in any kind of social relation, in any kind of antagonistic struggle, let's say, is that if only the particularity of the struggle is recognized without entering into relations of solidarity with other groups and engaging in wider struggles at the level of society, is that the group will be totally enclosed in its particularized demand and will have no hegemonic consequences at a wider level. Now, let me give you an example. There were some discussions in Britain after the Labour victory about how black people have to operate in relation with the Labour victory. And there were some positions saying From the point of view of black interest, it's the same thing that the conservatives or Labour had won the election. Labour has made very few pronouncements in defense of black demands. Now, this some people argue in those terms, some other people argue in a more sympathetic way to a labor victory within the black communities. Now, what would be a position of pure particularism? A position of pure particularism would be to say our interests to be defended are exclusively black ones, and libertarian spirit, which for a few weeks dominated British society after the election, is something from which we have to keep totally apart. Now, there is where I see that the whole distinction that, for instance, Gramsci made between a corporative defense of an interest and a hegemonic attitude. A hegemonic policy is one which tries to present particular interests as the necessary as necessary to carry out a wider social aim. For instance, I have given in one of my pieces the example of Mary Wollstonecraft. The rights of man and citizen excluded women, but her attitude was not to say, ah, so rights of man and citizen are purely black, purely male interests, and we don't have anything to do with them. They say, if rights of man and citizen are not extended to women, there is something by which there is an internal limitation to the extent of this democratic revolution in a variety of dimensions. Now, for instance, in America, the defense of black interests took place in the decades which followed the Second World War on a very comprehensive basis. They had a discourse which was not a purely particularized discourse, but a discourse which defends civil liberty, civic rights, in a much a wider sense, in spite of the fact that the reaction of the white establishment, even the liberal white establishment, to the assertion of this right was rather timid, to say, to put it mildly. No, I remember, for instance, a black activist of the 1930s, which later in his life, I don't remember his name, said, "The most sympathetic president that I have found to black causes in America was Franklin Roosevelt, and all concessions I got from him were at gunpoint." So these two dimensions are present, constantly there. Now, what I'm very much in favor of multiculturalism. In fact, I think multiculturalism is one of the great developments in American politics over the last decades. I'm concerned is that pure particularism can be overcome by a more comprehensive type of discourse. I'm not saying that pure particularism is predominating necessarily, but definitely is a danger which is potentially there, as it is in any group which starts having at the same time to assert its own identity and to insert, to inscribe this identity in wider causes at the level of national politics.
Okay. In your preface to Zizek's The Sublime Object of Ideology, you suggest that the Lacanian concept of enjoyment enables us to understand the logic of exclusion operating in discourses such as racism. This is a provocative statement, one that alludes to what might be at work affectively in the perpetuation of racist practices. Would you further describe the relationship you see between jouissances, how you pronounce it, and racism?
Well, in fact, when I'm asserting that, I'm simply summarizing an argument of Zizek. The argument is Zizek's rather than mine. But what it basically comes to is to the fact that enjoyment is very much linked to the practice of exclusion. For instance, if I am in a situation in which I feel vulnerable, weak in many respects, I project in some particular other the source of my own limitation. And in that sense, for instance, the black, the Jew, the Bosnian, whatever a group can be seen as the symbol of what is lacking in my situation. And the whole structure of enjoyment, which certainly is more complicated in Lacan than that, turns around this this double relationship in which the other is the negative mirror of my own lack. It's approximately that what the argument is about.
In a recent JAC interview, this is the following of another question I wrote, African-American feminist Bell Hooks suggests that if we are ever to understand the dynamics of race so as to move toward a truly anti-racist society, whites are going to have to begin to interrogate whiteness. And what she's suggesting is the necessity of understanding the relational character of racial identities. And given your interest in the making of political identities, what steps do you recommend we take to initiate such an interrogation?
Well, let me say in the first place that I'm very much in agreement with the assertion of bell hooks. When one is thinking about black identities or white identities, one is not thinking in two separate things. One is thinking in discourses which constitute whiteness through the exclusion of blackness and through the exclusion of many other things, because whiteness is a comprehensive category. You will exclude homosexuals, you will exclude many others which function in your discourse as the other. In that case, it's not possible to destabilize this form of discrimination without at the same time destabilizing the category of whiteness which constitutes the hardcore of positivity against which these discourses operate. So I agree very much with that assertion, because otherwise we would have the simplistic idea that you can simply incorporate rights or the defense of a set of groups without modifying the very identity of the groups which have represented the point of view of the oppressor. It's not simply of extending to other groups something which belongs to the dominant one. It's a matter that the process of this extension destabilizes the very categories of the dominant groups as such.
Yeah, that's good. I'm wondering if this doesn't sort of anticipate, not the next question, but the question after. You occasionally refer to the work of Homi Bhabha, and particularly his notion of hybridization. Do you find the work of post-colonial theorists generally useful in your efforts to theorize the discursive conditions, possibilities for emergence of new political identities? It seems related to what you were
doing. Yes, very much so. Precisely, well, the work not only of Homi, but also of Gayatri, I find very relevant from this point of view. But going back to hybridization, that is the point that you are raising here. The category of hybridization, I think, shows its potential precisely by pointing out these fears of ambiguity that we were describing before. What does hybridization mean? Simply that I cannot close myself in a pure identity of the oppressed. What we were saying about the oppressor before, also here, comes to the identity of the oppressed. The oppressed constitutes also its identity by denying the identity of the oppressor. But the process of advancing the claims against a system of the oppression destabilizes both the identity of the oppressor and the identity of the oppressed. And here is where hybridization becomes necessary, becomes important, because the oppressed, in the process of advancing its claims, will have, for instance, to negotiate within institutions. Now, once you negotiate within institutions, you are going to have the very operating the very ambiguities which are inherent in institutional struggles. If the identity of the group in asserting its claim is successful, the more successful the group is, the more this success will involve in participating in a variety of institutions, relations of power, and so on, which are going to be going to put into question the original demand. As at the same time, these institutions have a structure of their own. This structure of its own can, among other things, produce a cooptation of the original group, so that there is a limitation of the radicalism of the original demands. On the other hand, if they continue in a purely anti-institutional struggle, they do not advance hegemonically in society at all. Now, all kind of hegemonic struggle always take place by negotiating between these two mutual impossibilities. Each one of these two logics of social action led, if it is taken unilaterally, leads to social immobility, either by a pure segregationism in a purely anti-institutional struggle, or through integration in institution. And it is only by combining the two in a pragmatic way that one interacts with the other, that some kind of global advances of some causes is made possible. But there also is important the system of alliances, because it is only on the basis of broad amounts of social demand by many oppressed groups that success in this hegemonic offensive becomes possible. For instance, I have heard in America some years ago people saying liberalism system is absolutely dead. No radical democratic struggle is possible within a liberal framework. Well, this I think is pure defeatism, because in that case, if you don't want to influence the institution through change, what is the meaning of going to of organizing a march in Washington in order to defend a right to choose and so on and so forth? You are constantly trying to modify liberal institutions operating within the framework of these liberal institutions. I understand, for instance, the discourse which is alternative to operating within a liberal framework by if somebody says, I have a Leninist theory about the seizure of power. Because in that case, all your logic of social, of political action is different. But if you don't have any kind of alternative logic, and you operate in a purely ad hoc way without broad hegemonic objectives in mind within liberal institutions, probably your action is going to be limited as well. So here I think it is necessary to differentiate between liberalism in the sense we spoke earlier as different from a project of a radical democracy, and operating within institutional liberal framework, because what is the matter is to radicalize liberalism beyond the limits which were established by classical liberalism.
To alter it. That's right. Then going back to what I skipped, which actually follows from what you were saying, in New Reflections you state that destroying the hierarchies on which sexual and racial discrimination is based will at some point always require the construction of other exclusions for collective identities to be able to emerge. As you were talking also about this in another question. Certainly you don't mean to suggest that the struggle against racism and sexism is futile. How then are we to decide which exclusions are to be accepted, tolerated, and viewed as supportive of a radical democratic project?
Where is, I didn't see that thing. You jump to...
I had skipped that one and gone over to the Baba one.
Yes. This is the one you are asking me now?
Yes.
I see.
I skipped over it.
Okay, yes.
Because you seem to be right, almost answering the question already.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, my answer would be the same as earlier on about contextualization. Definitely, if you are struggling against racism and sexism, you are going to exclude from your project some people defending, for instance, traditional values. You are going to exclude a moral majority. You are going to exclude the Ku Klux Klan and groups like that. So asserting a radical democratic project will include this type of exclusion. For instance, people defending right to life, you are going to exclude as far as you defend some values, but this is in the nature of social antagonism. Now, in the what groups have to be excluded from a radical democratic project, that depends on how that society is structured, how a project of the kind could advance in a country like Argentina, or a country like Italy, or a country like America, is going to be completely different, yes. For instance, I don't know to what extent advancement of democratic causes in many countries of the Islamic world will involve the same type of exclusion that we would have in an American context today, and certainly that it doesn't. For instance, the relationship between democratic demands and Islamism presents a very, very complicated set of issues, because many causes that we would recognize as valid in the Islamic context, for instance, in the struggle against the Iranian regime, will have to accept at the same time the Islamic constitution of subjects in many other respects, with distinction and causes that we would not accept in the Anglo-Saxon world today.
That's right, but there's no... So in other words, apart from the particular context, there's no sort of mechanism for which we determine what's to be tolerated and what's not.
Only
it's
the...
always going to grow out of a particular...
Only, for instance, the kind of relative universalized value that we were speaking earlier on. Today, for instance, discourses about national self-determination are discourses which have won an almost universal acceptance from the international point of view. So there you have a certain universality of values, which on the basis of putting in equivalential change many things acquire this status. I'm not saying that everything is rigidly contextual from society to society, but the creation of hegemonic fronts around radicalization of democracy, in particular historical contexts, are going to be different from each other. Although I think the argument has to go more and more, that is desirable, in the direction of having as many universal values conceived in this particular sense as possible. But beyond that, we cannot go. Okay. For instance, even some of them are complicated. What, for instance, about the right of national self-determination? What if a country is committing a genocide inside its limit? Has the international community the right to intervene or not? You see how contextualized even a principle like that is?
That's right. That's
yeah.
Which is, of course, a major problem right now.
Yes.
In Power Representation, you discuss the complex dynamic of political representation, saying that the identity of the represented is transformed and enlarged through the process of representation. You also say that the representative inscribes an interest in a complex reality different from, and you have a quote there. Given this view of the transformative nature of representation, what are the consequences for a truly workable representative democracy? And, you know, maybe you might also think in your answer about the second part of that question, which is this not a description of a type of colonialism?
I don't understand the point about colonialism.
Okay, because if the representative if this transformation is happening of the interest of the represented and of the represented themselves, mm-hmm. This kind of, you know, how do we say this? This kind of this gives a lot more power to the representer, right? To sort of articulate and represent, and the other notion of represent, that is, to sort of decide what the interest is and how to define the interest. So, is this not a kind of not colonial move, but what, autocratic move?
I see. No, the word colonialism
is
simply.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I don't think so. The argument is more or less the following. Why a relation of representation is needed in the first place? Simply because a decision affecting your own interests is going to be taken in a place from which you are formally absent.
Yes.
You're materially absent, not formally.
Yes.
In that case, is inherent in the nature of any representation that the process is going to be a two-way process. For instance, let's take a simple case, which I think I have used, I don't remember in writing, but at least in a talk sometime. Let's suppose that you have farmers in a locality and that the only thing the farmer are concerned is the maintenance on a tax against the import of agricultural products. Now, and they choose a representative to parliament. The representative in the parliament cannot simply go and say, I'm representing the farmers, so vote in that direction. He has to construct an argument to convince other sectors different from the farmers. So he will have to speak about the effects on industry, the national interest, and so on and so forth, and said. And this type of discourse cannot be simply derived from the interest of the farmer, have to articulate the interest of the farmer to other things going in the national community. So, in some sense, the representative, by producing that discourse of articulation, is having an effect on the represented itself, because at the end of the process, the represented will have a more complex identity, a political identity, more incorporated into the national community, that at the starting point when they have a very punctual interest. So I don't think it's colonialism, because it's not that there are cases in which the representative can betray the represented, but these are banal, no? When this other process takes place, there is a circulation of discourses in this community by which, for instance, in terms of what we were saying before, a certain universality is created, because at the end of the day, the farmers of this locality will have not only a discourse about taxes on agricultural products, but will have a discourse about development of the national economy, threats, and so on, which will transform them into a more complex political people. And in this sense, the process is a two-way process from represented to representative, and from representative to represented, but at the same time, the identity of both is constantly changing in the process. Now, there are situations, for instance, the cases of total marginality that we were speaking before, in which people are totally dispossessed of the identification of an interest, and the discourse of the representative there is very important at the beginning in order to give to them some sense of identity that they lack otherwise. But this, I would say, is the most democratic thing that can be done in that context, because thanks to that new discourse, these masses are launched into political action and mobilization, and in the process of this incorporation, they develop more complex discursive of their own. For instance, the whole Gramscian notion of the organic intellectual was based exactly on this notion.
Well, that leads right into the next question, and I won't even read the lead up to it, just the question at the very end. How then does a member of a dominant group undertake the work of representing members of a minority group, let's say, in an ethical and politically progressive way? Or is that possible?
Well, firstly, I don't think this representing is done by a member of the dominant group. No, unless there is a split in the dominant group, something like that. For instance, if you have a dominant group in the south of Italy, which is very closely connected with the mafia, and you have a local lawyer who start agitating against the mafia and establish, trying to mobilize the unions and a variety of other groups, the discourse about this is produced probably an initial way by this lawyer, but this lawyer is not a part of the dominant group. It's somebody who is trying to confront the dominant group in that direction. What can happen, however, and that is probably the central meaning of your preoccupation, is that if you have totally inarticulated masses, whose level of political discursivity is low in this situation of marginalization, this task of starting organizing them can be initiated not only by progressive politicians, but also by the church, by reactionary politicians, by fascists, and this happens actually all the time. But that is exactly where hegemonic struggle lies on, because of this original lack cannot be identified with any positive content a priori is why there is this struggle between groups operating in that direction. For instance, in the south of Italy, the communist lawyer played this role of mass organization in that the first decades after the Second World War, simply by saying, well, here the working class is weak, we cannot base the part in the union activities in the north, but here we have that we can make sure that the premises of the party and the union, even if they are weak, are the rallying point of a set of struggles, struggling in the mafia, struggling because of, for the problem of water, school cooperatives, and so on and so forth. And in some sense, they articulated this variety of things, but there was no necessity that the communist discourse did that. In some other localities, the Christian democratic lawyers play a similar organizing role.
Just a few more, actually.
Yes.
Compositionists often deploy the term subject and subject position, but tend to make these terms synonymous. And you provide us with a more nuanced political vocabulary by making a distinction between the two. At stake in this distinction is the possibility of social agency. How might we rethink these categories?
Okay. Well, in hegemony and socialist strategy, we reduce, I think incorrectly, the problem of subject to the problem of subject position. Now, the problem of subject position can be retrieved by a structuralist discourse very easily, because you can say subject positions are objective positions within the structure, and what you have to do is to describe the structure as a comprehensive whole, and in that case, the problem of the subject is related simply to that. For instance, the notion of interpellation in the Althusserian approach led to some extent to this. We recruit subjects into the structure in this way. Now, that is the point, for instance, where Slavoj Žižek made a criticism of our position in the first one of the first review of hegemony and socialist strategy, which was published in LAN, which is the journal of the Lacanian in Paris, which was a very positive, favorable, and interesting review. But the criticism was that we were confusing subject with subject position, while a subject in the Lacanian sense would be always the subject of the Lac, that is to say, not a point within the structure, but the point of a Lac from which the logic of identification start. This was actually very important for my argument about empty signifiers, the way I developed it later. Because if the only thing we had was subject position, the very logic of identification, which involved the place of lack, the failfulness, and all that would have been unthinkable. So today I distinguish between subject and subject positions in this sense. Subject positions are part of the symbolic, but the realm of subjectivity is not exhausted in the symbolic. Otherwise, we would have simpler identity and no process of identification. So this is the main change that has taken place.
This next question is actually related to that. Throughout your discussions of the constitution of subjectivity, you shift the focus from identity to acts of identification. And at one point you say that we cannot give clear criteria for choosing that with which to identify. Now this move from identity to identification is part of the anti-essentialist mode of theorizing that you're very much committed to. What's striking about this view of subjectivity is that it seems to suggest that essentialism and identity politics should be reconceived as an effort to provide both the content and the criteria for choosing, or perhaps more accurately for regulating, acts of identification. Do you agree?
I don't think I understand the point. Can you? Is yours?
Do you want to move on?
Yeah. Okay. If we talk about feminism, kind of essentialist feminism that wants to identify women as, you know, relational thinkers, more you know, connected to the body, intuition, those sorts of things. So to provide a content to the signifier woman. It would seem that feminism as a political, that kind of feminism, that kind of essentialist thinking within feminism is trying to regulate how women decide how they act with which they're going to identify. They're going to identify as those things that they filled with the content, they filled the content of woman with. You see what I'm saying? So the question then is that, or the point of the issue is, it seemed in reading through your work on this shift from identity to acts of identification, emphasizing the process and the activity of identification as opposed to a substance and identity, that you might be suggesting a kind of critique of essentialism and identity politics as they're trying to regulate how we identify and how we choose to identify.
I think I understand if I'm answering something different from what you wanted to ask. Just tell me. Obviously, identity politics today is a very wide field. I don't think one can say that identity politics and essentialism are the same kind of thing. What identity politics, on the contrary, is something which has helped very much to expand the notion of subjectivity, and in this sense has helped also to break with essentialism in many directions. There can be, however, a form of identity politics which tend to a rigid essentialism, because any kind of identity can lead to that. Working class identity could lead to that. Liberalism in terms of individualism could lead to that. So there is no discourse which is immune to essentializing tendencies. But firstly, I would like to put into question the rationalism of the notion of criteria for choosing. Because it's not that somebody constitutes one's own identity by choosing this or that. Identity construction is a far more complicated process, and anybody familiar with psychoanalytic literature knows that the set of things that are involved in it. What I would try to say are two things. Firstly, the distinction between identity and identification is central. If one would have identity without requiring acts of identification, would be entirely at the symbolic level, in Lacanian terms, and the dimension of the real, which is absolutely central and which requires constant act of re-identification, would not be possible. Secondly, the acts of identification, when they take place, are not acts in which people choose, I'm going to be this, that, and so on, because of set of reasons like that. The thing is much less automatic than that. What I have is an original lack. This original lack requires acts of identification. This act of identification depend on many things, among other things, availability. For instance, when I was mentioning earlier on that if you lack a fullness, a discourse which proposes fullness by the being simply the only discourse available at some point can play these functions, and when the identificatory acts have taken place, it's very difficult to move away for them. But as far as the question, which I think I understand now, is concerned, I would say, yes, if we have an essentialism, we try to provide a priori both the content and the criteria of choosing, that would be something which would be incompatible with the notion of identification I'm developing. But I want to stress the fact that this affects not only identity politics, but any kind of politics.
Just three more questions.
Good.
You must be very tired.
Your work on hegemony suggests that it is urgent for progressive intellectuals who must operate in the vacuum created by the collapse of Marxism and the redrawing of geopolitical arrangements to understand the logic of hegemony and develop our own hegemonic strategies. Excuse me. What shape would you like to see these strategies take?
Let me think. You mean for progressive intellectuals? Mm-hmm. Where?
Well, I suppose in the United States.
Well, that is something you should ask to an American rather than to me. But let me think a bit what I can say. I understand that your question refers to intellectual task, because you are referring to progressive intellectual. Well, I see the development of a theory of hegemony as a precondition for any kind of strategic thinking, having to combine various tasks, all of which would involve, for instance, the expansion of rhetoric and rhetorical argumentation. The first place, I see that we need to have some sort of combination of what I would call various branches, various breeds of post-structuralist theory, and not only post-structuralism. For instance, the Wittgensteinian approach, I think, is very important to this matter. Mm-hmm. I think the construction is providing us with the a discourse concerning the deepening of the logic of undesirability, which, for the reasons that we have mentioned before, becomes central. I think Lacanian theory provide us with a logic of the lack, which is organized the logic of the signifier, which is also a discourse of an enormous importance. I, for instance, very much against these attempts of simply opposing the construction to Lacanian theory. I think the two of them can be productively combined in a variety of ways. And I think, finally, that the whole conception of microphysics of power can be complementary to this effort. I think one should not dismiss the work of Foucault, for the matter, Deleuze and Guattari, too easily, as some people tend to do. So what we have is a very complicated discourse which has to combine a tradition of thought we started from very different starting point, but I think are all convergent to political analysis. And, for instance, the analysis of the complexity of present-day society has to go together with an analysis of the proliferation of the places of enunciation. For instance, there has been, if a study in terms of places of enunciation is made, we would see that the transformation of politics over the last 30 or 40 or 50 years, let's say since the end of the Second World War, has multiplied the places from which enunciation, which are going to have political consequences, were possible. And this is linked at the same time to disintegration of classical forms of social aggregation. Now, once you have this multiplication of the places of enunciation, you have also a proliferation of rhetorical devices, given that we are dealing with process of argumentation, and this process of argumentation had to operate at a plurality of level, we are in a situation in which social theory has to advance in the direction of generalized rhetorics. This involves also that thought has to be more strategic. It has to emphasize the strategic dimension to some extent, but only to some extent, at the expenses of the structural one. Because structural analysis try to define matrices of constitution of all possible variation of meaning, while a strategic thought is a thought which try to see constant displacements of meaning in a regulated way, but the very regulation is something which is submitted to the very process of displacement. So this is to some extent the kind of theoretical activity in which I think the possibility of formulating a theory of politics oriented in a radical sense has to move.
Very exciting, actually. Two more.
Yes.
I'm going to...
freedom we have already dealt with.
Right, I was going to say that. And in fact, you've talked at length about the freedom, unfreedom, and so I don't even want to ask that question. I just want to ask what was at the very end of it. For people in the United States, it's very counterintuitive, you know, because we always think that freedom is this place that we go to. And your analysis certainly makes sense to us. But how do we change the public mind? How do we change, you know, that's such a monumental change of understanding of freedom. I wonder what practical ways there are to, or if there are any, to get people to see that.
Writing, giving talks.
But certainly not in the intellectual world, I mean, in the academic world, because...
You are speaking about the academic world.
In the academic world, academics tend to talk to themselves. Mm-hmm. I wonder how we make change out in the real world.
Well, I don't think that I would say that the academics are also part of the real world, and that their influence should not be undervalued. For instance, there are many intermediate areas, some form of journalism, some form of circulation of ideas, in which it's important to engage oneself. Finally, intellectual development have produced a set of historical effects. Without the development of Milton Friedman theory and all this, a set of the history of the last few years would have been different. Thatcherism couldn't have not developed the way it did, and so on. What I think is important is that intellectuals do not produce only high theory, but that also write in ways which are accessible to a wider public. There is this intermediate area of discourse, which I think is very important to develop. And in fact, many people are writing in that in those terms. This is not to say that abstract theory doesn't have to play its own role, but it's not the only kind of discourse to which we have to devote our time.
Oh, well, I look forward to reading your piece in the popular press.
Okay.
the last question.
Yeah, sure.
Because you're attempting to think a unique radical project, one that avoids the debilitating particularism of postmodern thought and the idealistic universalism of Habermas and other liberal projects, many theorists are likely to misunderstand or take issue with your works. And we thought that you may want to address at this time, you know, any particular misunderstanding or clarification that you think that people ought to hear.
There have been a set of misunderstandings. Some of them are just quizzical. Some of them are more important. Among the quizzical ones, let me just mention to you that I wrote this article about the impossibility of society, meaning that society cannot be sutured in this way and so on. A few years later, Margaret Thatcher said that society does not exist. Meaning, obviously, something completely different, saying that the only thing which exists are the individuals, which for her are away. Some people, in a certainly not innocent way, try to make a confusion between the two things. For instance, Terry Eagleton wrote once about the theory of the impossibility of society developed by Margaret Thatcher and Ernesto Laclau. but apart from those malevolous attempt at conflation, this is the book on ideology. Apart from these malevolous attempts at conflations, there could be some other misunderstandings which are more important. Firstly, from the Marxian side, we have never tried to simply put aside Marxism as something which had to be abandoned. What we try to operate is to operate deconstructively within Marxian categories in order to present a discourse which certainly went beyond Marxism, but which nourished itself from Marxism as one of its roots. Now, many orthodox people didn't take that lightly, and they accuse us of being some kind of renegades. So, the other thing, which is perhaps more important, is that this intermediate position, which is not intermediate actually, but it's something which tries to go beyond the two extremes, concerning universalism and particularism, has also presented some difficulty. For instance, people coming from the Habermasian camp many times thought that our discourse could be identified with pure particularism, which is not the case. And some people have seen in our attempt to introduce this universalistic function in the way I have described some attempt to criticize the discourses of the new social movement, which is the last thing we were trying to do, because for us, as I said, multiculturalism is an absolutely progressive phenomenon. And finally, I think there is some kind of discussion going on, but there I don't know if they are misunderstanding or simply impasses or areas of ambiguities in my analysis that can that have given place to very different readings. For instance, Slavoj Žižek has always insisted that I was developing a basically Lacanian approach without formally using a Lacanian language. He insisted that our category of antagonism and hegemony was a rediscovery of the Lacanian real. Mm-hmm. There are other theoretical approaches which, on the contrary, are very positive about our work, but they don't like the Lacanian appropriation of our themes. That is probably a debate that is going to go on in the next future. There are, I have received some pieces which try to enter into this argument, and I simply reserve my final opinion for the moment in which I go through all this literature.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.